Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talk to the author of The Field Guide to Elvis Shrines. We visit a soda pop emporium in Homer, learn about the Princess Theater in Leroy, and Todd Gleason remembers the Great Flood of 1993. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. People leave a lot behind them. It's amazing to see what tumbles out of old books, for instance. Charlie Schlenker reports on rediscovered pieces of memory once treasured, then forgotten by their owners.
Inside Babbitt's bookstore in Normal, there is the pleasantly pungent smell of old books. Stacks of volumes are on shelves, counters, and the floor. Babbitt's owner, Brian Simpson, riffles through the books people sell him before shelving them for resale. People leave behind pictures, greeting cards, and whatever is handy to use as a bookmark. Occasionally, there is even money. The oddest thing Simpson has found is a picture inside a collection of 1930s erotic poetry. The photo was of three nude young women who are variously, barely, modestly, and well endowed. He says they were smiling, as if they were having fun at a carnival in an era when eroticism was still innocent.
Well, this person, I think, had two kinds of books. The kind of books that he put in the upstairs bookcase, which were your basic, you know, somewhat libertine authors. Maybe some D.H. Lawrence would go upstairs, and the illustrated erotic poetry would go downstairs. Down with the id in the basement.
Simpson says when he buys books, particularly from estates as this one happened, he feels he knows the life of that person, their failures and successes, what they like and dislike. Newspaper clippings on authors or topics related to the book are commonly found in books, as are obits. Simpson doesn't like those. They turn yellow and the acid contaminates pages. Connie Lolliman, who works at About Books in Bloomington, says she recently found four pictures taken in a strip.
And this was a very funny one, this round-faced man with a hat just perched on the top of his head. And he went and sat in the photo booth. You know, you put in a quarter and you get a strip of four photos. So here's three of him with a very serious face and trying to look important. And then the last one, he's like got his head tipped back and I said, that's the one that made his hat look best.
With the photo of the man was another later picture of a lady standing in front of a big ship, a military vessel. She's wearing a Jackie O pillbox hat with a veil, white gloves, and a dress. These fragments inspire Lolliman to make up her own tales.
I always take him up, Stacy, and I always have a little conversation about, oh, what do you think this guy was doing, and why do you suppose, you know, she's there, and she's dressed this way. What do you think she was doing? And yeah, we have a good time with it. Like the lady with the ship, I said, oh, she was trying to get on, but they wouldn't let her, so she just stood next to the boat and had her picture taken, you know, because it's like, no, ladies don't get on the ships, and, you know, just goofy things like that.
The ephemera left for latter-day buyers also tells something about bygone eras. Brian Simpson has found keepsake airplane tickets from the 1960s when flying was not as ubiquitous as it is now.
It was really interesting to look at the ticket and the envelope it came in and how flying at that time was a very luxury sort of thing, and so the tickets certainly reflected that. The way the flights represented with flight attendants, we call them now, the stewardesses at the time, the tickets were a little bit more ornate and simply by the price too.
Of course, what people see in these old keepsakes, it depends on their point of view. Connie Lolliman likes the nostalgic tokens and finds them uplifting. Brian Simpson admits to being a fairly cynical person.
Sometimes those happy memories seem to have a certain sadness to them, and that, you know, that's about all they had, you know, and these happy things, there's a bittersweet quality to them that it says a lot more than just a happy memory.
The history buff, the closet libertine, the firm-faithed, religiously observant person who had a preference for bloody lives of the martyrs are all there to be found. Davy Rothbart edits a journal about things people leave behind them in public places called Found Magazine. He says the irony in many discarded items is rich in the human condition. A passionate love note on the occasion of a 3-month anniversary of a new boyfriend appears on the flyleaf of a book called The Story of Pecos Bill on the Eve of Killing His Wife. And there is poignant estrangement shown by the inscription in a gift copy of the Communist Manifesto.
To my parents, may you one day understand the seeds of discontent that motivate my very will to live and fight for the betterment of humankind. Love, John. The book was in mint condition. The spine had never been cracked.
Rothbart says there is something raw and intimate about seeing people reveal themselves this way, but he thinks a certain amount of voyeurism is actually healthy.
I think we're surrounded by strangers all the time, just walking to work, sitting on the bus. I think it's natural to have a curiosity what other people's experience of being human is like. And that's what I think these finds offer us. But maybe to have that moment where you recognize yourself in it and you say, oh my God, I've written that same pitiful love note 100 times before.
Rothbart says looking at these lost bits of lives, finding meaning in the note of a stranger, may help you feel more connected to other people around you. So he says, do your to-do list, drop off the videos, pick up the dry cleaning, and then add a grandiose item, like learn to live free, to inspire someone else. Put it in a book to give away or offer to a used bookstore. I'm Charlie Schlenker, WGLT News.
This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. This month we mark 27 years since the passing of the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley. In that time, Elvis's image has grown to mythic proportions. During August 7th through the 16th, Graceland, Elvis's home in Memphis, will be celebrating Elvis Week, marking 50 years since the start of the singer's career. If you think Graceland is the only place to visit to immerse yourself in everything Elvis, well, you are very much mistaken. Bill Yenney has recently updated his book, The Field Guide to Elvis Shrines. It lists places all over the country that are somehow connected to Elvis. The book is published by Last Gasp of San Francisco. I talked with Yenney recently and asked him, when he started this book, did he think he would find so many Elvis locations?
No, I really didn't. Really amazing how many places that Elvis traveled and places that Elvis touched in his life. I think one of the decisions that I made that added a lot to the book was to include all of the concert venues where Elvis performed throughout his career, including his early career when he was just working out of the back of a pink Cadillac and driving across Texas with Scotty Moore and the rest of the band.
Well, your book does read not just like a travel guide, but also this history of Elvis's life. And my question is, how tied to these places where he lived and he worked and he went to, how tied was he to these locations?
Well, there's to a varying degree, he was tied to these locations. I think that certainly the places where he lived, there was a close relationship to the locations. The homes in Memphis, obviously Graceland is he was extremely tied to that. Other places that he lived, such as Lauderdale Courts, the housing project where he lived during high school, he probably couldn't get out of there fast enough and probably didn't go back. Other locations around the country, there were certain concert venues where he performed once and never went back, others where he went many times. So as far as being tied to these locations, he was tied to them for specific periods of his life for the most part, or they were places that he visited a few times and moved on.
Your book deals in the first half mainly with two towns, Tupelo and Memphis. Tell us a little bit about each town and what the big attraction is. I mean, some of it's obvious, but maybe besides the big one, I guess the not-so-big attraction in that town.
Well, I think with Tupelo, obviously that was the place where he was born, so so the Elvis Presley birthplace is important. You've got the hardware store where he bought his first guitar, or his mother bought it for him. That's certainly a place of interest to fans.
And there's even a marker on the floor where the transaction took place.
Yes,
I love that.
And that's probably fairly close to being the exact spot where it happened. And other locations in Tupelo, not to be forgotten, is the graveyard where his twin brother is buried, who died shortly after they were born. And then traveling up the road to Memphis, this was the city where he lived most of his life. It's where he grew up, went to high school, bought his first house, which was not Graceland. It was the Audubon Drive home, and lived there for about a year, then moved to Graceland. Obviously, Graceland is sort of the most important Elvis site. But others include places where he bought his cars, places where he liked to go to dinner, Sun Studios, which is where he recorded his first music, and quite a bit of his subsequent music, especially during his early years when he was at his prime, and other sites around town, places where he worked before he became a superstar, places where he bought his suits, places where he bought his medical prescriptions during that horrible last chapter in his life, and the hospital where he died.
That in Memphis. Well, it sounds like there's no spot too big or no spot too small to include in this book of yours. You have Graceland, then you said you have all these other places where he, did his dry cleaning and got his suits and stuff.
Well, I think if somebody is going to take the trouble of going to a place, to a city, to look at the major sites, they'll probably want to see some of the other places, because I think you visit Graceland, you certainly get a sense for how he lived. But I think that the other sites add to the texture of his overall experience in Memphis, and certainly enhance the overall experience of the fans traveling to Memphis. Why not visit the high school that Elvis attended? And those kinds of things add to the to your feeling of what Elvis was about, and because they certainly influenced him in subtle or in some cases overt ways.
Well, Graceland itself and the surrounding few blocks has just become this huge Elvis experience. They have the museums, they have everything.
Yes, you can get a great deal out of visiting all of those museums. I remember when I made my first trip to Memphis after Elvis passed away, the area across the street was just a lot of cheap souvenir stands. It hadn't really developed. Now it has developed tremendously with the Automobile Museum, the Airplane Museum, the recently opened Heartbreak Hotel, which wasn't on the site when we did the first edition of the book. It's parenthetically, I wonder why it took them so long.
Seems like a natural.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the idea of having a hotel called the Heartbreak Hotel and having a Elvis channel on the TV, it seems like an obvious thing to do.
I've stayed at the Elvis Hotel. I love the fact that they do have 24-hour-a-day nonstop Elvis movies in every room, and there's a big guitar swimming pool out front.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to have that, and that's all part of the Elvis experience. That's the real sort of centerpiece of an Elvis experience. But I think the other sites are also important because they give more of a feel for the texture of his life, and then the experience of driving from place to place. And the book includes several driving tours of Memphis and a walking tour of downtown Memphis. Taking these driving tours and the walking tour, you're traveling from place to place, but you're experiencing the same sort of driving from place to place that Elvis would have experienced when he was traveling from between these locations.
Okay, so let's move out of Tupelo and Memphis. Tell us about this place called Graceland 2, spelled T-O-O.
Oh, Graceland 2 is one of the real strikingly bizarre locations in the world of Elvis. It's a building that looks a little bit like Graceland, but the real activity is what goes on inside. The people who live there are a family of Elvis impersonators. It's a man who named his son Elvis Aaron Presley McLeod, and the kid became an Elvis impersonator. And Paul McLeod, who's the proprietor of the location, at one point his wife had had enough and told him that it was either his Elvis obsession or her, and he told her to get lost. Last time I visited, they had televisions on in every room with VCRs running so that they could record anything having to do with Elvis if it happened to come on. I assume they have TiVo now, so that would make that better. It's kind of on one level the ultimate shrine. It is a two-story house that's literally encrusted with every imaginable Elvis knickknack.
Why do you think people have this religious connection to Elvis? I mean, in fact, your book, it doesn't say guide to Elvis locations, it says guide to Elvis shrines. So why do you think people have felt this way about Elvis?
I've tried to figure that out myself. I've tried to delve into it, and it's I think it's like a lot of religious experiences. It's something that almost defies words, but it's something that where there's an ethereal attraction to Elvis. There's something about his his charisma that never went away. There's something about the sound of his voice that still evokes the same goosebumps that it did when he was alive. There's something about just sort of the magic of his presence. I think there are certain stars like Elvis, like Marilyn Monroe, possibly, like James Dean, possibly, who have this sort of intangible something about them that makes them larger than life in a time when they have no life, when they are just a memory. And I think those are the kinds of things, and there have been doctoral theses written on this subject that Elvis fandom is really like a form of religion.
That was Bill Yenny, author of The Field Guide to Elvis Shrines. It's published by Last Gasp of San Francisco. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. A swing musician who recently stopped by Central Illinois has looked to Brazil for inspiration on his latest CD. Illinois Public Radio arts reporter Laura Kennedy spoke with John Pizzarelli about why he's now moving to a bossa nova beat.
The son of Benny Goodman alum and guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli, John Pizzarelli took up the guitar in his youth. He attributes his musical versatility to growing up in a house filled with all sorts of music.
So dance a samba, so dance a samba, bye 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 bye. So dance a samba, bye.
My father being the guitar player and liking all styles of music and playing all those styles of music in my house when we were young was a big help to me, just loving music in general.
Although predominantly a player of swing, one evening Pizzarelli heard João Gilberto's record Amoroso, and he was won over by the thrilling bossa nova sound.
I love the sound of the guitar player's singer, and as it relates to the Brazilians, everybody in Brazil, it seems to me, plays the guitar and sings, and that's what I do in a different style of music, and I've always had a great admiration for this style. And basically, in a nutshell, this is a culmination of all the years of listening to that and finding different records and trying to put together the things that would best translate my love for that music onto a record.
This is just a little samba built upon a single note. Other notes are bound to follow, but the root is still that note. Now this new one is the consequence of the one that we've been through. As I'm bound to be, the unavoidable consequence of you.
In 1998, the Pizzarelli Trio was kicking off a tour in São Paulo, Brazil. They were playing at a club called Bourbon Street when a spontaneous request from the audience created a unique moment that went on to inspire Pizzarelli's new recording.
They literally wanted us to do what we do, which is mostly songs from what they call the Great American Songbook, like Paper Moon and All of Me and I Got Rhythm. And we did a 90-minute show of that, and when we were taking our bow at the end of the night, and a man in the front row said, they were yelling encore, and he said, do the girl from Ipanema. And when we played it there was a hush over the room. We played the song, and then after the first chorus, I had sung the first chorus in English, the whole audience, shoulder to shoulder, sang the song in Portuguese, and in the most beautiful tone that you ever heard a group of people sing. And it was just magical. And then we saw this repeated over and over again on the tour, and that's sort of also what gave us the idea, where people kept saying, you must do an album of Bossa Nova. You have to do this, because they were really enjoying our feel for it. So that was also one of the real sparks to us doing this record.
On his new CD, Bossa Nova, Pizzarelli teams with a special guest for a tune that many consider the quintessential Bossa Nova song.
Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes,
Daniel Jobim, the grandson of Antonio Carlos Jobim, was in town in New York. We were making the record, and then when we were doing Girl from Ipanema, we said, gee, you should sing a chorus in Portuguese. It would be great, you know, to represent your... It's really the 40th anniversary of the release of the original record.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem e que passa.
So far, Bossa Nova has been the fastest seller of all of Pizzarelli's CDs. And he adds that a second Bossa Nova CD is a real possibility for the future.
We really did a lot of the basic tunes on this record, like One Note Samba, Girl from Ipanema, So Dance a Samba, Desafinado, Waters of March. And now from hanging around Daniel on this tour, he's played a lot of the... There's a lot of other songs that we could have done that we didn't want to do the first time out, and so I'm hoping maybe somewhere down the road we'll do it all over again.
Pizzarelli feels the end result of his new release, Bossa Nova, is a true marriage of American and Brazilian music. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The rest of a stump on some road, a sliver of glass, a life, the sun, a night, a death, the end of the run, and the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the end of all strain, it's the joy in your heart.
John Pizzarelli's new CD, Bossa Nova, is available on Telarc Records. Still to come on the program, Todd Gleason remembers the Great Flood of 1993, and we visit the Homer Pop Emporium. Stay tuned.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, host of the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week here on WILL AM 580. Earlier this spring, the rains continued across a good portion of the Midwest, and some of the analysts I speak to on a weekly basis here on WILL started to compare this year to 1993. Now, that was 11 years ago when a great flood, in fact, what climatologists say was either a 250 or a 500-year event, came and rolled into the Midwest, flooding thousands, actually millions of acres of cropland, destroying farms and homes and businesses. It was that year that I was working here at WILL as an employee. and I was also moonlighting at the Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District as a bus driver. I saw a chance that year to combine those two jobs. I volunteered to drive a group of volunteers to the levees on the Illinois River, where they were sandbagging in a desperate effort to save about 20,000 acres of cropland. On the way down, I handed those volunteers my tape recorder and said, "Please tell me who you are and just exactly why you've decided to come along." And then all day long I collected natural sounds and the events that were happening there near the Illinois River and that levee district. Today I replay that for you to give you a vivid idea of how this community helped a community near the Illinois River in 1993.
I used to live in California, which has a lot of disasters, so I thought, as long as I'm here and there's a disaster, it would be good to go and help people out.
My husband and I took a trip down to St. Louis to see how bad it was about a week and a half ago, and I just remember seeing an old man sitting up on the side of the street with everything he owned around him, knowing that, like, probably the insurance wasn't going to cover everything. It didn't look like he had a wife or anybody to turn to for help. So I thought that I would come down and try and help out and try and make a difference.
And I woke up this morning and thought, I have so much. I'm one of the luckiest people in the world, and if I can help, that's why I'm going.
I just quit my job, and I'm unemployed, so I can't send money. So instead of that, I think I'm going to go, you know, try help out manual labor.
I have a six-year-old son, and he's here with me today, and for me, it's a way to show him that he should help people when he can, and to teach him so that as he grows, he'll help others.
Because I seen the reports, and it was really awful because people have their houses, have floods all around their houses, and it's bothering them because they don't want the water to get inside their houses.
Okay, directly in front of me is a pile of brown sand with lots of sticks sticking out of it, and lots of trees, and lots of people, men with shovels, women with bags and gloves, everybody just bagging lots of sand.
I'm holding sacks open so this young man can put sand in it and this young man can tie him up.
I fill the sandbags. I take the shovel, get some sand, fill the sandbags.
Well, we have people holding bags open. Another person shovels 2 to 3 bags of sand in the bag. And then another person ties the bag, throws it in a pile, puts the sandbag in the truck, and away we go.
Taking a truckload of sandbags to behind Bill Smith's tenant house, which is down in the northwest corner of our district. There's prisoners down there that will unload the truck, and they're taking them downstream on boats and four-wheelers to where the sandbagging points are. We farm about 1,000 acres of just beans, corn, and occasionally wheat. And we have a hog farm operation also. Several hundred hogs. That's basically what we do. We use some of the corn we grow to feed our hogs. The last time this district flooded was in 1926 when the creek levee broke, and the river levee's never broken. But normally we don't have any flooding problems. 1973 was the last time the river got this high, and we've surpassed that, of course.
Come over here to the levee, and the truck was going to bring some sandbags and throw them off by hand, and when we backed up, we got a sight that there was probably 30, 40 prisoners, maybe 50, and they were just throwing the sandbags, probably more than a normal person could, and there was guards around telling them, you know, just to get into a cadence and to get into their system of the way that they were supposed to do, and really they were a great bunch of guys because they just minded and listened to what their man said all the time. And now they're moving on down to another section of the levee that is supposedly weak, and they're going to try to get it more secure.
Stand still, Sergeant F! Stand still, Sergeant F! Stand still, Sergeant F! Stand still, Sergeant F!
I'm in Dixon Springs Boot Camp, and I'm here to help the people with the flood. We're here to pack sandbags, fill sandbags, make levees, repair levees, do whatever it takes to stop this water.
Lunch today was one slice of ham on a sandwich, and it was a good lunch, all you could eat and drink. We had a good time.
We get the food from the Red Cross. We were getting the food from the Red Cross out of Quincy, but now they've transferred us to Alton, and it's real good food. We have a cold lunch, a sandwich and fruit, potato chip, and snacks, any kind of snacks they want. And then for dinner, we have a hot meal, fruit and a hot meal. It's usually some kind of a barbecue or a stew or, last night we had spaghetti and it was really good. We order 250 meals a day. And lots of times in the afternoon, we'll get a call from the levee that they haven't eaten. So we get busy, and maybe we'll fix up 35, 40 sandwiches and potato chips and a fruit and a drink and take it to the levee for them. And this is a garage, and we have fluorescent lights. We have a ceiling fan, and we have a large fan back there that the food is stacked in front of. It does keep the air circulating. And I think that is someone's speaker, I believe. That's someone's in a band or something, so we use that for a table for a drink. And this is, what do they call those? That they carry things on?
Pallet.
Pallet, yeah, a pallet with some plastic over it that we made a table. And over here we have paint buckets stacked with two boards. That's where we take care of most things. We're not set up to wash dishes or anything. We're just, everything that we do, we throw away. It's disposable.
Chick Spangenberg is my name, and I've lived here in the bottom since 1949. I just retired last year, but I still live just a couple of hundred yards up here. And this is just amazing, the people that's come in here to help. I just can't get over all the volunteer help that we've had here. And without the volunteer help, originally the volunteer help before the National Guard got in here, the volunteer help helped save the district. But they were completely wore out by the time the Guard got here. If the Guard hadn't got here, I don't think we could have done it, because they were just completely exhausted by the time the Guard got here. Now the Guard's here, and we're back in pretty good shape. And one of the mistakes we've made here, we should have had everybody sign in when they came in. They've came in here from Chicago and Wisconsin and Champaign and Indiana, and then just, you name it, and there's people volunteered and came in here and drove many miles to get here to help. I can't get over the fascination. That really gets me, of all the volunteer help. It restores your faith in humanity. There's no question about that.
Now he's going to turn this in on overtime now.
By the way, the piece you just heard was produced in 1993 on a trip I made south into the Illinois River Basin, where a group of volunteers from Urbana-Champaign were sandbagging a levee. That levee broke the Sunday after the story was recorded, flooded more than 20,000 acres of agricultural cropland. I was reminded of the event earlier this year when the rains were falling across the Midwest and much of the crop in Minnesota and Iowa and Wisconsin and Michigan had come underwater, and some of the analysts I speak to on WILL were beginning to compare this year to that year. Of course, we know now that this year was not like 1993, and as the climatologist would tell us, it's not likely that we'll ever see that kind of event again, at least in our lifetime, as it was a 250 or a 500-year event in terms of weather. I'm Todd Gleason for University of Illinois Extension and WILL AM 580.
You're listening to Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. This weekend in downtown Leroy, the Princess Theater reopens. It was originally built in 1916 and for the last two decades has sat vacant. The movie theater has been refurbished and is ready to start showing films again. David Kraft is one of the people behind the renovation of the Princess Theater. And he's actually done this sort of thing before, renovating the New Art Theater in downtown Champaign last summer. I talked with Kraft recently and asked him what was happening out there in Leroy.
With my sister and brother-in-law, we purchased the Princess Theater on Center Street back in October. In November, we tore off the roof and reframed it, resheeted it, put a new roof on. There was no power or heat or water or anything, and so this spring, we waited till the spring before we really started the remodel. But we've been slowly and steadily, you know, just replacing everything. There's all new water, new electrical, new sewer line, new HVAC, and we've been busy just working through the theater stuff, like insulating the walls and installing the seats, building the concession stand. When it closed in 1982 and it opened in 1916, it had one toilet to serve the entire theater, but, you know, we've gone back with ADA bathrooms, we got new seats, put in ADA seats, and just bringing the 1916 building up to, 21st century standards and conditions.
Well, you mentioned that this theater is from 1916 originally. What's the history behind the Princess Theater?
Well, and it was built in 1916 by Marcus West, whose father was kind of one of the founders and his family of the Leroy area. West Township is just outside of Leroy and actually encompasses part of Leroy. So the West family built it and operated it for several years. And then the Freeburg family took over in 1937-38 and ran it for 30 years. And when you talk to a lot of people in Leroy and the surrounding areas now, I mean, they remember the Freebergs operating it. And after 68, when it closed, a couple people tried to operate it, and it would go for a couple of years and then not really work out. In 82, they showed the last movie was shown there. For a while, it became a country western dance type club, and then later a teen club. But both of those were short-lived, and then it basically sat empty for 20 years until I stumbled across it on the internet and decided to go take a look at it.
And that's all it took. You just found it on the internet and said, hey, this looks interesting.
Yeah, there's a website called cinematour.com, and they have pictures of theaters from all across the world, but in the United States, they're grouped by state. So it was actually June, 22nd of 2003. It was the day after the art theater had reopened. I was now, since I didn't have to go there and work on remodeling it anymore, I was kind of bored and looking online at all the downstate theaters and saw the one in Leroy and it said closed, and I just drove over there to take a look and saw that it was, there was a for sale sign on it, and it, you could tell it was in rough shape, but I knew that, you know, with the, it's a brick structure that, you know, I love historical old properties, and I knew that, you know, with a lot of hard work that we could probably get it to where it really is today, to a functioning movie theater. But I'm lucky because my brother-in-law is a contractor, and, you know, he's a builder. He builds homes and does commercial stuff. So having him, you know, when the art theater, when that was remodeled, I mean, that was really just like redoing the lobby and upgrading the equipment stuff. But in Leroy, this was a complete, you know, gut rehab, just all from scratch, basically, except for the brick walls and cement floor.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, you've done this before, as with the art theater in downtown Champaign. What is it about bringing these old movie theaters back to life that attracts you?
I just, you know, I've discovered personally, I have a lot of rental properties and rent out the apartments, but I really enjoy buying a place and fixing it up even more than the day-to-day management of it. And with the theater, I mean, it's a big project, so it takes a lot of time, which in a sense is good for me. It gives me something to focus on for an extended period of time, but also the fact that you get so much positive feedback and encouragement from people. I mean, I have in the past bought houses, you know, basically gutted them, fixed them up, and rented them, but, and it may sound selfish, but it's that, you know, you get so much more positive feedback with the theater. People express their appreciation and on a frequent basis, and that's part of it. I just enjoy, like I said, I enjoy historic properties, so when I see the theater there, you know, with the broken windows and all, you know, junked out, I just think this is something that I would like to save. And I don't know if it's a coincidence with them that it's movie theaters, but you know, and maybe if there was a different scenario, I could do something else, but I enjoy that, and it's been fun for me. And for the theaters, I don't really enjoy going to multiplexes. I don't think that's the proper presentation. It certainly isn't the way movies were meant to be shown, where you hear the sound from other movies bleeding through the walls and they're herding you in and out like cattle. So I think that just by having these single screen theaters, it just gives people an alternative to the multiplex presentation.
And you think these single screen theaters can survive?
Well, several do in the area. I mean, there's, you know, Onarga has one, Villa Grove has a twin place, and, you know, Greg Boardman also has the Lorraine Theater in Hoopston. There's the Normal and the Castle in Bloomington already. So I think so. And one thing is that by, you know, doing a lot of the work ourselves, we kept our costs under control, so there's not as much pressure on us.
Now, usually small theaters like this find their niche by doing art films and independent films, but you're not going to be doing that, are you?
No, not really. Because we're so far from a multiplex, most of the film companies have no problem giving us first run movies. So we'll do mainstream films either, you know, on the first run with the national release, or like when we open this next weekend, we're going to do Around the World in 8 Days, which is a sub run, a second run movie. So we'll just kind of mix them in, you know. Again, 52 weeks in a year, most movies will show 1 week unless it is a first run, and most of the distributors will require a 2-week commitment. So it's just going to be a matter of us of picking movies that that we think people want to come to, and then keeping the movies fresh, you know, turning them over so to give people a chance and a reason to come back.
And the debut screening for the new Princess Theater is?
August 6th, 9 p.m. That's the first show for the public. And then Saturday the 7th at, the final times aren't set, but tentatively 2:30, 5, 7, and 9. And then Sunday at the 8th, we will do 2:30, 5, and 7.
And if people want to find more about the renovated Princess Theater in Leroy, where can they go to?
There's a movie line, which is 309-962-2770. Or my website, which is www.craftproperties.net.
That was David Kraft one of the people who helped restore the Princess Theater in Leroy. The theater is set to open this weekend. This is Sidetrack. Sometimes business opportunities fall in your lap, but you wouldn't want what Christine Cunningham sells to fall in your lap. Not long ago, Cunningham, who owned an antique and craft shop in the town of Homer, discovered that a newly added item on her shelf was making her business, well, fizzier. Tom Rogers opens the door to the Homer Emporium, which now boasts the biggest collection of soda pop around.
The story of the Homer Emporium starts with its building, smack in the middle of Homer's main street, where the traffic of Route 49 whizzes past a couple of blocks of mainly empty storefronts. Ray and Christine Cunningham wanted to help spur a revival in their hometown, so they bought the old Oddfellows Hall 2 years ago, rehabbed it, and opened their store. They even got an old cash register for the counter.
All right, $1.25 on that one. Don't get that sound just anywhere.
Then Christine realized that a recent addition was selling fast.
We bought an old Coke machine that worked, and so we filled it with some bottled sodas, and we kept selling out. So we just kept expanding numbers of varieties, and it's just kind of exploded from there.
That Coke machine is now joined by two hefty coolers that hold nearly 250 varieties of soda pop. And with only a few exceptions, most of them are in bottles. That's another sound you don't hear much anymore. Cunningham bet right that people's nostalgia for forgotten and obscure flavors in substantial, heavy glass bottles would lead them to her store.
We get a lot of people who come back to Homer. They've moved away, and they stop back to their hometown, and they always come visit. But we have had people from out of state come just for the pop. They've seen our website, and we've had people from Ohio and Iowa and Michigan who've come down just for pop.
You're calling it pop, by the way.
I grew up calling it soda, but everyone here calls it pop, and so I've kind of switched.
The Emporium has the usual big-name brands, and some that seem to drop off the map. Remember Tab or Knee High? And there's pop for the adventurous, too.
We have Loco Soda, which is a lime with chili pepper. We have a very, very spicy ginger ale, the spiciest ginger ale out there. We have a lot of sodas made with cane sugar instead of corn syrup, which is becoming more and more popular. Double Cola is one of the small bottling companies that still is in existence, but has just become very regional now, so people can't get it.
Though Cunningham gets some of her pop from distributors, she and Ray get an awful lot of their product by getting into their car.
We go to small regional bottling companies and pick it up. So we spend a lot of time and effort collecting the sodas. Chicago and St. Louis are the closest places we go to get anything. We've driven to Wyoming. We've driven to Tennessee and the Carolinas to get stuff.
And when they get back, they say hi to the regulars who are sitting around a couple of tables at the front of the store.
You gonna make coffee?
No, there's fresh grounds in there.
Oh, never been used.
Customers like Don Clem and Robert Lee gravitated here from the restaurant across the street, where they spent many an hour before the restaurant closed a few years ago. With no alternative back then, they took up the kitchen table at a neighbor's place.
Don and Louise Morgan had coffee down at their house for, what, 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years. We'd go inside when it was cold, and we'd be out on the front porch when it was hot. And then she came along and opened up here and
saved her souls, didn't she?
Yep, saved Louise.
The guys say they have all they need now at the Homer Emporium. Coffee, good company, and a few bottles of pop. For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
You can see pictures of the Homer Emporium's transformation from abandoned storefront to soda pop haven at homer-emporium.com. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Join us again the first Wednesday in September for another edition of Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.